Good morning. So hopefully you're here for CS 3330. So, Professor Rice, so I'm going to give a bit of introduction to what we're going to be covering this semester. Go over a little bit of logistics, but mostly it's going to be actual material, but I will go over logistics later, so please hold those questions for later. So this is computer architecture, and the idea is that in this class we're going to cover sort of these layers of abstraction, and we're going to cover basically the piece from sort of a little bit of C down to, you know, assembly you've seen before. We're going to go a little bit over assembly that you've hopefully kind of sort of remember from 2150, maybe. We're going to talk a bit about machine code, which you hopefully kind of sort of remember some ideas about that from 2150. And we're going to talk also about, you know, implementing that in hardware. And we're going to look at, you know, things that go all the way from C to the hardware and things that we just do in hardware. This is not going to be a class where we talk about the real details of hardware. So I have down here this idea of gates, transistors, registers, wires. For the most part, we're just going to say that we have these things that we'll talk about later, if you don't know what any of those are, the ones we care about, that we can use to build hardware, and we're going to have some higher level abstraction. And that higher level abstraction here is this notion of a hardware design language. So we're going to have something you sort of like a C for building hardware. That's what we're going to work up to. So we're going to have a C, but instead of compiling to assembly, it compiles to gates, transistors, and registers. And that's going to be how we build something which interprets machine code. And if you remember machine code is what we do when we take very mechanically assembly and convert it to something that has a binary form that hopefully our actual hardware will be able to directly understand, because although we probably really don't want to make hardware which reads A followed by D that turns out to be both annoying to implement and pretty inefficient. So in this class, we'll happen to be using C. So you might say, why are we using C? So big reason is that, well, you kind of already know it, sort of. It's almost a subset of C++. I say almost because there is a surprising amount of valid C code, which is invalid C++ code that you will see, but it's close enough that we can basically not go over most of the stuff about C syntax because you've already seen it in 2150 and it should come back to mind when we use it. And this class is really about how we build processors, how processors run your programs. And C is handy in that sense because C has a direct correspondence to assembly. Now, when I say there's a direct correspondence, you might think, well, that means that if I write some particular C code, then I can predict what assembly code will come out. And that's not the kind of direct correspondence I'm talking about. This means that I'm telling you, you can do a very straightforward manual translation to assembly, but your compiler might not be doing this. So your compiler could do this most obvious transformation to assembly, which is why we're using C, because we can sort of represent things you would do in assembly in something which is machine neutral, doesn't involve us picking things like register names and worrying about calling conventions all the time like we would in real assembly, and still talk about how that corresponds to things, you know, with the natural translation to assembly. But your compiler, as we'll discuss a little later, might not take the obvious approach. So your compiler might not say, you know, you wrote x plus equals y, that's an add instruction. Your compiler doesn't have to do that. Like you would do that, your compiler can say, maybe I don't want to use an add instruction this time, and you might see that sort of thing. But we're using C because we can have this direct correspondence, so it's an easy way to talk about code that doesn't look as ugly as assembly and doesn't have things like choosing registers, and still allows us to talk about what it's going to do on the underlying machine pretty directly, unlike something like Python or Java, where we have all this extra stuff going on. Like in Python, we have to figure out what type is this variable anyways. And that's a lot of extra work, so it's not so obvious how that corresponds to the actual hardware running the code. And because we're going to use C, especially near the beginning of the semester, you should have access to a Unix environment with a C compiler. You should be getting department accounts, hopefully by the end of the week. I sent them a list this morning. If you register for the class late, we may need to send them an extra list, which will give you access to the department Linux machines, and there's instructions which are off the course website, which you should have access to via Colab, for accessing these when you have an account. There are some other options. So if you run Linux, Linux is our de facto environment. If you run Linux either natively or in a VM, you can do all the assignments on your own machine that way. So if you don't want to have to worry about network access, that will work. Probably most of the assignments you can do on natively on OS X or natively on the Windows subsystem for Linux. But the supported platform is department machines. Many people succeed at using laptops. If you have trouble with your laptops, I'm not going to have a TA sit down with you figuring out why your laptop is broken. We're just going to say, hey, we have these department accounts, use them. We know they work, and we have actual IT staff for them. So that's going to be the answer if you have trouble running things in your laptop, is use the department machines. They're supported. We have staff for that. You know, you might find it less convenient, but that's what we're doing. So before I move on, any questions about Unix environment, C compiler? Okay. So that was the top of our layer of abstraction. And I just have assembly here, written x86-64. So this is what you already know, in theory. We'll be talking a bit of review of x86-64 assembly. So one reason is our textbook, which is this book, which you should have a copy of, because I assure you we'll make some of the assignments a lot easier. And there are some readings in it. Our textbook uses the other syntax for assembly, AT&T syntax. So I'll talk about briefly that, so you can read the textbook and understand what's going on. And because we'll have some tools which will use that too, that's the default assembly syntax on Linux, so it comes up. And there's some things that you have either often forgotten or haven't seen from x86 assembly we'll want to talk about in more detail. One example is how conditional jumps actually work. There's something called condition codes, which at 2150 usually doesn't mention or really glosses over. Okay, so then we have x86 assembly, and below that we translate that to machine code. And you might say, well, you should be translating it to x86-64 machine code. What is this Y86 thing? Who is Y? So this is a machine code made up by our textbook authors. So they only support a sort of subset of x86-64. So they decided that they're going to make this subset called, they call Y86, which omits most of the instructions. So real x86-64 has, depending on how you count, you know, order 1,000 or 2,000 instructions. But we have an assignment where we want you to implement a processor. We're not going to have you implement a processor with 2,000 instructions. That would not be a good use of your or our time. Also, even if we take a subset of the instructions, the real x86-64 encoding is pretty complicated, and not for good reasons. It's complicated because basically the backstory here is that Intel made this 16-bit processor, and they decided to make a 32-bit processor based on that, but they didn't want to change the encoding very much. So they decided, we're going to have this encoding where we're just going to be sort of compatible with the 16-bit processor and just add a few extra stuff. And when they were doing this, they did things like going from having 4 registers to 8 registers. So they just sort of tacked that on. And then later on, AMD said, oh, I like Intel's ISA because it's widely supported, but I want 64-bit version with twice as many registers. So they tacked it on again. And this comes up all the time in the real encoding. So the real encoding does things that don't make any sense, like put different parts of what register an instruction's using spread across multiple bytes for no good reason, just because of this history. So we're going to use an encoding, which the textbook has, which is much cleaner. Now, this is simple compared to x86 64. It's hard for anything not to be. But it's not like IBCM, which you may have seen. So it's a variable length encoding. So instructions are going to be different sizes. There's more than one register. We have actual conditional jumps, and we have stack manipulation instructions. So it's considerably more than IBCM has. But like IBCM gives you the general idea of machine code, if you remember that from 2150, which I know many of you took like 2+ years ago. So that's our machine code. And the purpose of having this machine code, this sort of raw bit form, is that we're going to eventually need to have something which takes those bits and actually does what the instructions should do. That updates memory and registers, and therefore has something that we can call the registers in memory. And we're going to be designing that. And when we design processors, you can think about doing this in multiple different ways. So one thing you could think about doing is, well, a processor is a physical thing. I'm just going to lay out the physical components physically by hand. But this is not how people make processors. And you could also think of people saying, well, I'm not going to lay them out by hand, but I'm just going to like make a something like an architectural drawing where I have all a big thing, a big drawing where I've marked out where every component goes and all the connections between them. So these are real things you could do to make processors, but they're not very nice for the same reason we don't write all our programs in assembly. You don't want to deal with all the details of where exactly do I put each component, how do I do an addition, and so on. So typically, people who design processors in the real world use some higher level language to represent hardware. Something that we'll call known as a hardware design language. So we have one we're using in this course, which is built specifically for this course. It's based on a hardware design language in our textbook, but we've modified it over the years to be a little more flexible. And this means that you won't deal with details like, how do you build a memory? We're just going to say, you have this memory, you just use it. You won't deal with details like, how do I lay things out? That's totally abstracted away. And this is typical of sort of most of what commercial processor design is like. There are times when you need to figure out where exactly do I put everything on a chip. But for the most part, you have something that kind of looks like a programming language, a high-level programming language, where you specify how data moves on the chip, where, what you do in each case. And that gets compiled down to this next level of gates, transistors, wires, and registers. Just like our C code gets compiled to assembly. And yeah, just like when we compile C code, there's lots of clever things that compiler could do to be more efficient, and so on. But the fundamental idea is that we just don't want to deal with those details. And usually it's straightforward to come up with something which works for that, but we're not going to deal with that in this course. In particular, we're not going to talk in this course, for example, about how you build an adder. That's not this course, that's another course. We're just going to say, we have adders. They're a high-level thing we can access in our hardware design language. We'll just write x plus y, and our hardware design language, if it was compiling to gates and transistors, would put an adder in there for us, rather than us writing out what an adder actually looks like as a bunch of hardware components you connect together. So any questions on that? Yeah. So the question is, how does HTLRS compare to Verilog or VHDL? So Verilog and VHDL are the two sort of most common real hardware design languages. So it is considerably simpler just because it has less stuff. And mostly because it's missing some of the details you would need to actually synthesize hardware. So we sort of said, we could figure that out, but this is a tool for teaching, so we're not going to have you specify things you would actually need to specify to synthesize hardware. And we're only going to support things needed for our assignments. So our HTLRS tool has several places where it really assumes you're building a Y86 processor, which obviously the real tools don't do that because they want to be useful for no matter what kind of processor you're building, or even if you're building something, some sort of circuit other than a processor. So other questions? Okay, so one way you can think is that we're going from C down to this hardware description language, so figuring out how do we build processors. And I know some people always complain in this class that I'm never going to build a processor, there aren't that many jobs like that, or I just want to get a programming job, why should I care? So there are other things we're going to talk about explicitly where understanding how processors are built is really helpful. One of them is program performance. That if you want to understand how fast is my program, you need to know sort of how the hardware works. And you might say, well, why is this? You might think, well, I already know assembly, and sort of the obvious thing to say is, well, there's each instruction is going to be like one unit of time. If I just know what the assembly looks like, I just need to know how much assembly is there. That tells me how fast it is. And that's a model which works on some very old processors, perhaps, but is not actually how real hardware tends to work. And there's two big issues, which mean that just knowing what the assembly looks like and saying counting instructions is not going to tell you what your program performance is. And we're going to talk about both of them a lot in this class. So one of them is parallelism. So fast hardware, when we're trying to make our hardware fast, is parallel. And the reason is that if we have, you know, a circuit that does an addition and another circuit that does an addition, and they take in two inputs, they can run at the same time. We don't need to do one at a time. It's not like a program. If we have two things which do additions, they can both do additions together as long as they have independent work to do. And real processors take advantage of this fact that basically hardware is inherently parallel. If you have a circuit which does something and another circuit which does a different thing, they can both run together, you know, and do different computations. They're always running. You've paid the cost of having, in this case, two adders. You might as well try to use them all the time. So real hardware that tries to be fast is parallel. It does multiple things at once. And if you want to get maximum performance out of real hardware, you need to make sure it has multiple things to do. It's not any good to you that our machine can add two things at once if you don't have two things for it to add at the same time. In that case, you have half of this hardware which is being unused by your program. So knowing how processors work can help you take advantage of this hardware, make sure it has multiple things to do and can do these things in parallel. So another big reason why you can't just count instructions to figure out performance is caching. And this is the idea that accessing recently accessed things is faster. And the reason for this is that we have our memory hierarchy. We have a small, fast memory and a large, slow memory. And when you access memory, what really happens is that first we go to the small, fast memory and we say, you know, do we have it? If yes, we say we're done. And if no, we go to the large slow memory, and the same accessing some piece of memory ends up being slower. And our processors manage the small fast memory automatically for us by trying to keep things which are recently accessed in there. And so by understanding how you know whether something's in that small fast memory, how to make sure your program is structured to take advantage of that small fast memory, you'll be able to have your program run a lot faster. And this is not just like, you know, 50% faster. This is often like orders of magnitude faster. But because this is something which doesn't show up at the assembly level, this is how the memory that you access with things like move instructions works, you need to know how the hardware works below the assembly level to take advantage of this. And both of these issues are complementary to our traditional algorithmic efficiency. So in other classes, we spend a lot of time talking about Big O. Big O still matters. These are things you can do which sort of matter in addition to Big O. Like, you want to get the best Big O you can, but once you figured out the right algorithm to use, there's work you can do with that algorithm to make it take advantage of parallelism and caching. So questions on either of these? Parallelism, caching. Okay. So another thing we'll talk a bunch about, including probably the biggest topic from today, is going to be what compilers are and do. So you kind of know that a little bit from 2150 and from having used compilers in pretty much every class in some form or another. And this might help you know, sort of like, if you want to understand why, what are these compiler errors mean, what is, you know, linker errors, understanding how we structure executables in modern operating systems so we can run them, so if you need to make compilers, or if you're debugging an application and it comes up, like, what did the compiler do? What did the linker do? What's going on? Why is this behaving weirdly? It will help you understand that. And another thing that will come up is we're going to talk a bunch about memory management, including, you know, things like how we support in hardware running programs on our machines. So when you learned about sort of assembly and IBCM in 2150, we had this sort of notion that there was a single program running on the hardware, but we know that's not what my laptop is doing. I'm running lots of programs all at once. So we're gonna talk a bunch about how that works. And as part of that, we're gonna explore things about, you know, like, what is a segfault? How do we have programs interact with each other? Because this is something which involves interacting with the hardware. We need to know, how does the hardware let us run multiple programs together and have them, you know, not interfere with each other? And there's, in fact, a bunch of hardware support we'll talk about to do that. And this is useful both if you're running on something where there's multiple programs and you want to understand how that works, and if you, of course, you need to run an operating system that runs multiple programs together, you obviously need to know what the mechanisms are available to you to let them run together. So, those are things we hope you to learn. This is my hopefully mitigating the none of this class matters to me questions. It's also a required class and we have exams, but you know, don't really want that to be the reason you're doing things. So now let me talk about a completely different topic, powers of two. So everyone's seen powers of two. I'm mentioning powers of two both to preview some terminology that will happen in this class, and because there's going to be times later in this class where if you have most of these memorized, it's really helpful. We talk about caching in particular in virtual memory. So powers of two, we have 2 to the 1, 0 is 1, 2 to the 1 is 2, 4, 8, and so on. And in this class, I'm going to use k to represent 2 to the 10. Yes, I know that that's not really what k means in the system international units. And you sometimes might see people who want to be very precise about that use KI for instead of kilo kiba. So we have K for kilo, KI for kibi. But when we use K in this class, we always mean the power of two. So 1 kilobyte, 1 KB is always 2 to the 10 bytes. It is never 1,000 bytes in this class. Because we just never have any reason we care about powers of 10, because we're dealing with bits. It's always powers of 2. And similarly, 2 to the 20, which is about 1,000,000, is going to be M. 2 to the 30 is going to be G, and so on. So something you might notice here is that this 2 to the 11 here, that's equal to 2 to the 10 plus 1, which if you remember your arithmetic with powers of 2 is 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 1. Remember that 2 to the 10 we said was a k, so this is 2k. And similarly, if we say take 2 to the 15, this is 2 to the 10 plus 5, so this is k times 2 to the 5, which is 32k. And this is really handy for doing quick back of the envelope calculations or even exact calculations to be able to do this conversion and see, oh, 2 to the 15 is 32k. So you think about, and I want to make sure that you can do that. And you can do this with other powers. So here I have 2 to the 31. That's 2 to the 30 times 2 to the 1. We know 2 to the 30 is g, so this is 2 gig. So any questions about what I just did there? Great. So that means that doing the same for these should be no problem. Give you about a minute. Needs more time? Okay, someone want to give me some answers? No volunteers. Okay. So, for the first one here, and the general trick you'll notice is that when you have a power, the tens place tells you whether it's K, M, G, T, and whatever other symbols we might care to memorize. We probably won't be using much more than terabytes in this class because currently aren't in the universe of lots of petabyte machines. So it's going to tell you the power. So we split this up into 2 to the 5th times 2 to the 30th, and we know 30 is G. So this gives us 2 to the 5th, which is 32. If you do this a lot, you'll memorize that. If not, well, you can figure out the first 9 powers of 2 by hand pretty quickly. And this will tend to be a lot less error prone than trying to figure out going all the way up to 35, where you will probably make an arithmetic error or like a data entry error in your calculator somewhere, or like off by one and figuring out where you are. Okay, so that gives us 32G. Then we have 2 to the 21, and again, it ends up that we take this 2, tells us what we have a 2 to the 20th. So this 2 here is being our 2 to the 20th, which is m. So we have 2 to the 1, m. 2 to the first power is 20. For the next one, I wrote 512. Some people sometimes like writing 1 half k. I probably wouldn't, but that's that you might find that easier to work with in some problems. Just note that we had the pattern that we used the first digit here. Don't make the mistake of using the first digit there and saying, oh, it's a 9, so I need whatever comes after, 9th after t. Don't do that. And for this last one, we have a 1 here. Remember, that's k. And then we have 2 to the 4th k. 2 to the 4th, and that's 16k. You didn't remember that. We have 2 to the 0 is 1. 2 to the 1 is 2. 2 is 4. 2 to the 3 is 8. 2 to the 4 is 16. Could figure it out. Just multiplying by 2 each time I go down a line. So any questions about this? Okay, good and straightforward. And this means you can go the other direction. The answer I'm looking for is 2 to the blank, not the decimal number or the binary number. That would be a waste of time, and we almost never want that. More time? So way I would work this out is we have this is equal to 16 times 2 to the 30th. I can just write my 10, 20, 30, this table here so I can refer to it later. And 16 happens to be 2 to the 4. You could figure that out with repeated multiplying by 2 if you didn't have that memorized. That's 2 to the 4, not 24. So we get 2 to the 4 times 2 to the 30th, so that's 34 for 128k. Again, the k turns into 2 to the 10th, not 21 to the 0. And we have 128 times that. And 128 happens to be 2 to the 7th, which again we could figure out by repeatedly multiplying by 2. So 2 to the 7 times 2 to the 10th, which is 2 to the 17th. This is 4 times 2 to the 20. So this is 2 to the 2 times 2 to the 20, which is going to be 2 to the 22. And for terabytes, we've hopefully figured out that it's 2 to the 40 here times 256. It happens that 256 is 2 to the 8th. So this is 2 to the 8th times 2 to the 40, which is 2 to the 48. So any questions on these? So, as I mentioned, there will be time later in the semester when being able to do these sorts of calculations relatively quickly will be helpful when we're dealing with memories and caches, which have sizes which are generally powers of 2 or related to powers of 2, where you won't want to be you'd rather do, 16G divided by 4M than 16,700 divided by, whatever 4M turns into as decimal. Don't be doing that. Because 16G times 2M, we can then do 2 to the 34 over 2 to the 22, and we find out that that's 2 to the 34 minus 22, which you can actually do on paper relatively quickly. Okay, so that's powers of 2, that little interlude. I promise you that'll be important semester. So now, second interlude on logistics. So lectures. So Professor Van Kott, who's assigned to the other section, we might change that on SIS so we're both assigned to both sections, we'll be splitting this course. So most of the lectures in the first half of the semester, by which I mean approximately up to exam 1, will be me, and most of the ones after that will be Van Kott. I say most, there will be exceptions. But basically, I will be lecturing basically up to exam 1. Van Kott will be doing most of the time. Van Kott will be doing most of the lectures after that, but not all of them. And there are two sections of this course. We should have roughly the same lecture in each section because of that, which is something we're trying to do because we share labs and it would not be very nice to have one section have very different preparation for the lab and the corresponding homeworks than the others. So speaking of labs, we have labs and homework assignments. So the labs, the grading is basically, did you make reasonable progress? So we have some metric before which we're going to give you full credit, which is often a little bit less than the lab purports to require. And the grading is pretty loose. And there's usually pretty generous partial credit. And collaboration is prohibited on the lab. Since you're in the lab, you are welcome to work with other people in the lab. That's fine. The homework assignments are usually introduced by a lab. We have some homework assignments which will literally start with, take what you did in lab and add to it. And some which will be like a more of a conceptual introduction, like it's on the same topic as the labs. Hopefully having done the lab will help you understand the homework and do it more efficiently. The homework assignments are due at noon on the next lab day with some exceptions that we will talk about when they come up, and are to be completed individually. Individually means that you should not be getting code, pseudocode, from other students. You should certainly not be getting code or pseudocode from the internet. We should not see that. And we also have exams, which are on the schedule, which is posted now. If you cannot make those exams, you should let us know early, not just before the exam, and certainly not after the exam. Yes?
Can we start labs early, or are they only available the day of?
So labs, so most lab, we'll go to here. So most labs are gonna have electronic remote possible submission. I say most, it was all of them last semester. We might be changing the labs a bit, so that might not be the case. Well, and when that's true, you can start them early if they're posted.
Oh, gotcha.
On the course website, I have things marked as tentative. I do not promise anything marked as tentative is in this final form, but you're welcome to start it, but there might be like things that are tweaked, usually small things, but not always, before we get the final version. Okay, so that's a course. So we have other coursework. So we have quizzes. So in my part of the course, we're gonna have, starting around the add deadline, which is after next week, we will have pre and post quizzes. So pre-quizzes are based on the readings, which means that especially for the stuff our textbook covers well related to HCL, we want you to actually read it. So we're gonna try to see if maybe some of you do that, maybe a little bit. So it'll be pre-quizzes, which will be taken online, which will be based on that. I'll go over the logistics of that later. And there'll be post-quizzes, which will be due after the lecture on things we probably covered in lecture or lab. In the later part of the course, Venkat's not excited about pre-quizzes, so he plans to have some sort of problem sets, which will probably be similar to what we would ask on a post-quiz, but in some cases, they'll be tied with homework. We'll talk about the logistics of that later. And this is when we have more homeworks which are more substantially connected to, more substantial than the homeworks early in the semester, which are kind of a hodgepodge, as you'll see, because we cover a bunch of half-review topics, and by the after exam one, we're into homeworks based on, less review stuff. Okay, so speaking of that, labs and homeworks aren't quite synchronized with the lectures. So for example, we're gonna cover how HCL works before exam one. You're gonna do the HCL assignments after exam one. This is because we need to cover stuff before you use it. You wouldn't appreciate us talking about all the processor design stuff after you've done part of a processor design assignment, and we have several weeks of that. But just know, I know this is a problem. We try to make it as good as we can, but there might be some cases where we cover something and, then a week or two later, we actually use it in homework or lab. That's just how things go. Okay. Talk about quizzes closer to the first one. Okay. Attendance. For lecture, attendance is strongly recommended. I am recording my lectures. This is an audio recorder I'm holding in my hand. I should have a screen capture. And this is both assuming I don't screw things up, forget to press keys, or run out of battery. There should be a recording of every lecture. This is to help you review. This is not intended to be a substitute for actually attending a lecture. I do not think most students have good experiences when they try to use it in that way. I know a few people that works for, but most people it does not. The main purpose is to help you review, and I know it is definitely helpful for a lot of students for that, but it is not intended to be a substitute for that, but you're adults, you can decide what makes sense for you. I don't intend to take lecture attendance. Oh, it is. So, late policy. If you have an exceptional circumstance, if you're sick, if you have some interview travel or something, contact us as early as possible, preferably, and we can often do something about it. Otherwise, for homeworks, 0 to 48 hours late is minus 10%. Doesn't matter where in those 0 to 48 hours you are, it's minus 10%. 48 to 72 hours late is minus 15%. Anything else is no credit. We will tell you how you did, we won't give you credit for it. For late quizzes and labs, generally the answer is going to be no. And the reason is that we will usually release answers, or sometimes release answers. So for some quizzes, we'll have like a homework assignment after it, which is supposed to start, sorry, for some labs, there'll be a homework assignment which says, start with your lab solution. And we'd like to give a lab solution out to the people who maybe didn't get things working in lab, but that means that we can't accept late lab submissions because there's a solution posted right there. And for quizzes, we'll generally release quiz answers to help you review immediately, automatically, and we're not going to deal with that. So if you have an exceptional circumstance, we can make something happen for quizzes. We can take you on your honored unit look, for labs, you can take you on your unit look solution. For quizzes, we'll usually just drop it and make other quizzes count more. But generally, we don't accept late submissions for those. For homeworks, we have this late policy. I note that we have a bunch of homeworks that spill on each other, so be careful about that. But the policy is there. Do that. So we will have a calendar on the website with office hours. They aren't posted yet. They should start next week after the lab. And obviously, the next week's lab will be staffed. This week's lab will not be staffed. If you go to lab, it will be empty. So, you know, you can go there, but probably not useful. We will have office hours posted in a calendar on the website. We should have a lot. I would say, I guess I wrote plenty on the slide. In retrospect, knowing what happens at some points in the semester, I maybe should not say we have plenty of office hours. Also knowing me trying to get more and more TAs from people, that I shouldn't say we have plenty, but we have a lot. I encourage you to use them. RTAs are usually helpful, and I would like to know when they're not. And certainly, you should be doing this instead of like banging your head against the wall on the assignment, not knowing anything about it. And also, like, maybe if it helps you establish a habit of like maybe not starting the assignment Tuesday evening before it's due on Wednesday, that'd be great too. Okay. And otherwise, so to-do-wise, I mentioned the C environment. Please make sure your department account or C environment works before lab next week. The first lab, you will not be able to run on a non-Linux machine, so you better have a Linux environment for it. And we would recommend a department account, but you know, you better have something. And I would, so you should get an email about department accounts by the end of this week. If you don't, please let me know, and I will work on fixing that for next week. I guess also on another logistics note, so I know this section has a wait list and the other one doesn't. I do not intend to increase the capacity of this class because I don't think we have enough lab slots to justify that, and I'm not super happy with the number of TAs I have that I want to like increase the number of lab slots. However, if you have a conflict with the other section, please email me. I can probably ad hoc permission you into this lecture. By a conflict, I mean you have some other class that you can tell me what class that is that you definitely need to take at the other time. A conflict is not, I really like this math professor and want to take their section of probability and not someone else's or something like that. It's like you have a class you couldn't take otherwise because of, and take the other section. Also, if you're waitlisted for a lab, I would note that at last checked, the 6:30 p.m. lab has open seats. I know some of you may have conflicts with 6:30, but I don't think that many of you do. And a few other labs have a few open seats, but the 6:30 one has more. So please be aware of that. We're not, if you don't have an actual conflict with 6:30, we're not gonna let permission you into some other lab to help you avoid a late lab. Yes? So generally, for labs where where the submission is electronic or remote, which is going to be essential, almost all of them, we don't care if you show up to lab, just full stop. And otherwise, there might be some things where we have you do something on paper, maybe. It's up in the air. I'm sorry, I can't be definite about that, in which case we might have to show up to the right lab. But for the most part, we don't care. The general rule is that if you're showing up to a lab that you aren't registered for and the TAs are really busy, you shouldn't be the one getting help. Obviously, people who are actually registered for the lab should have priority over you. But if the TAs aren't busy, absolutely, like, I'm fine with you sitting in lab from 12:30 to 6, just using free TA time. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Do you have lab tomorrow? No. If you go to lab, there will not be many people there. There is a schedule on the website, and also writing information on the website, and I don't care to talk about it. Okay, so that's our first half of Vic. So let's go to sort of things more directly related to the course. So I gave our high-level overview. We had our stack going from C down to these processor transistors and gates. So let's talk about sort of what our actual processor is and how it runs programs. So we have a processor, which is somehow connected to memory. These are our essential components. And there's some connection. We're going to call this connection here a bus. And the processor here, this processor, if you remember, this is where registers are. It turns out that there's also a cache, which we'll talk about later. But our model is that the processor has these registers, and it's connected to the memory, where our program's actual instructions and data are, by this bus. And the processor sends an address and either gets data back from the memory or sends data to the memory for that address. Okay. So this seemed like a good computer. This is all the real components we need for a computer, right? We don't anything else we might want. Anything that, you know, this is all I really need. I just need a processor, some memory. There I have a computer. So that works. Is there anything else I might want to have for a computer to work? Yeah. Disk. So we want like some sort of device with storage, and yeah. So we want these I/O devices. So I didn't write disk on here because I was thinking of the most immediate ones, which is that, well, it's not very useful to have something which accesses memory and, you know, computes on it if I can't actually see the output and give input to it. So disk, monitors, and so on. And we're going to say that these are, we have something I'm calling an I/O bridge here, where the processor, instead of just sending things to just memory, it can send things to these I/O devices and this piece of hardware, which we will not talk about the details of how it works, sort of decides to send things to memory or to these I/O devices. And in part of not talking about how it works, that this I/O bridge might be on the same package as the processor or not. But the processor does the same thing. It has this bus. It sends an address, and it gets data. So that data could be instructions to run. It could be machine code. It could be keyboard input. It could be something to write to memory. If we're doing a push instruction, for example, we need to write something to the stack. But that's what our processor is doing. Our processor is this little machine which has a teeny bit of storage and registers, which reads some machine code from memory and sends things to and from memory based on what that machine code says to do, then reads the next piece of machine code. So our operation is that we store this program counter, which is one of those registers. The CPU sends the program counter value down this bus. The memory says, oh, that's for me. Here's your machine code, and it sends the machine code for, say, a push instruction. The CPU reads the push instruction, says, okay, I'm going to need to, and it's going to say, you know, the CPU is going to say, send the stack address plus the data equals, you know, RBP's value. So it's going to send the do the operation corresponding to that push instruction and update its registers based on it. And then it's going to send the next PC to get the next piece of machine code to run. So this is our basic idea of this fetch, execute cycle of our processor. And our processor is basically this little machine which sends out addresses and sometimes data to this memory and receives them back. And sometimes we need to do I/O. The way I/O works in this model is that we sometimes send an I/O request the same way we ask for something from memory, but instead of getting back the data from memory, we get data back from, say, the keyboard. But the model is the same. We have this instruction which tells us, use this address, send it down the bus, and the hardware that the processor is connected to figures out, that comes from the keyboard, here you go. And it's just the instructions hopefully tell us to do the right thing with the value we get back. Okay, so this is our model of processors, memory, and I/O devices, just a high level view of what our machines look like. And basically all our processor is doing is it's reading some machine code from the memory and then doing what that says. So either that can just have it change its own registers, or it might require it to get some other stuff from the memory or the other I/O devices from that same place it got the machine code. So we sort of have this interleaving of read machine code, read other things, read machine code, read other things, or write other things, depending on what the machine code says to do. But the memory is really where, you know, most of our program's data is. So let's talk about memory. So memory, for this class, is an array of bytes. So each byte has an address. Here I'm showing a 32-bit memory. We're going to have a considerably bigger memory in our design because we have 64-bit addresses. But I just wanted to save space in the slides. So this is an array of bytes. Byte is 8 bits. And memory, each byte just has 8 bits of data. And the CPU determines whether that's machine code or, you know, part of the stack based on how it's accessed. If we're accessing something because you did a jump to it, then it's machine code. If we're accessing something because you pushed, then it's a value on the stack, probably an integer or maybe a pointer. If we're accessing something, using something to make a memory address, it's a pointer. If we're using something to just do normal arithmetic, it's a number. So the CPU determines how to interpret this array of bytes based on how you access things. There's no actual types in here, it's just bytes. I can draw memory in multiple ways. So on the left side, I have memory where at the top of the page is the address with the highest magnitude, and at the bottom of the page is the address with the lowest magnitude, and the opposite on the right side. The contents of memory do not change when I do this. So it doesn't matter, clearly it's the same values, I just drew it differently, it doesn't change what's actually in memory. That's important to note because we're going to talk about endianness. So endianness is, well, I have an array of bytes, but a lot of things we do try to access more than a byte. So for example, on our department machines, this int is 4 bytes on a department machine. And here I'm saying I want to access a four byte int starting address 42000 hexadecimal. So that's accessing 4 bytes, but each cell of this memory is 1 byte. So first of all, we have to figure out which of the 4 bytes do we access. We know one of them is 42000. What are the others? And the rule is that we just increment the address. So the address we're accessing is always the lowest magnitude address of the value. So it's those 4 bytes. And we need to take those 4 bytes and decide how do we turn those into a single integer. And there are 2 choices, and they both, we can name them based on what do we do with this lowest magnitude address byte here, this 0. So one choice is that we say the 0 is in the least significant part of the number. That it has that 0 is the value which has the least effect on the actual number it's going to be interpreted as, in which case we get hex 0302010000. So the the lowest magnitude byte has the least significance. And the other option is that it has the most significance the other way. So this first option is called little endian. The least significant byte has the lowest address. And the second option is called big endian, where the most significant byte has the lowest address. So the way I like remembering little versus big endian is it's all about what the first address, the address that the point, the byte the pointer actually points to, whether it's big or little part of the number. And note that I'm phrasing this in terms of, you know, the address as a number, so we don't have to worry about whether it's up or down or left or right on the page. Doesn't matter how I write things on the page, doesn't matter how I lay out the memory. This is just based on the number of the address, and that's how I'm going to refer to endians. So any questions about this idea? We want anyone not feel like, you know, if I gave you a picture like this and ask you to give me an, you know, a little endian or big endian value at another address, you could not do it. It's, you need help. Back there? Question? No? Okay. Okay, so in this class, because we're using things which are based on x86, generally things are going to be little endian, unless we mention otherwise. And it's going to come up a bunch because pretty often we're going to need to take things from memory and figure out what value is it. Okay, so speaking of memory, we have a peculiar layout you may remember for program memory. So here I'm showing you typical memory addresses you might see on a 64-bit Linux system, like our department machines, that we have some region of memory that is used by the OS near at these very high addresses. We have a stack at some address that usually starts with 7F something. And we have our actual code, our writable data. This is like global variables. And our heap, this is malloc/new, and some other dynamic memory. This is our typical where things are laid out. And we have our stack, which is where we keep sort of active function calls. On x86, the stack grows down. I think was mentioned in 2150, just make a reminder. So the top of the stack has the smallest address. This is not the only choice x86 could have made, but they made it. And that's what we're going to be using in this class. So when we push something on the stack, we're going to a lower address, even though we call that the top of the stack because we're naming things after the stack data structure rather than, you know, what the addresses are. So questions on that? And if you remember, the stack is where we store things like arguments that don't fit in registers. In the x86 64 calling convention, if we have too many arguments, we run out of registers, we need to put them somewhere else. It's where we store on x86 the return address. If you remember, the call instruction writes this and the return instruction reads this. Where we store saved registers and local variables that we can't just keep in a register all the time. Okay, so that's our memory layout. And we also have this coding constants and sort of global area. And this is what the compiler figures out. So this whole thing, conceptually, this is what is in our executable. So this is what's in the .exe or other executable file. And this is what we load when we load the program. All this other stuff, this is this here and this here, is filled in as the program runs. Like, we don't need to load it from disk because we just generate it on demand. We don't have stuff on the heap until we call new or malloc. We just need to load the code that actually calls new or malloc. We don't have stuff on the stack until we start calling functions. We just need to load the code which is going to have all those call and push and pop instructions that you vaguely remember writing in 2150, maybe. So let's talk a bit more about the process of producing this executable. So you want to produce something where we have our code and our global variables and our constants all together ready to be loaded into memory. And we don't actually do this very directly in a sort of C-like environment. We have a bunch of steps. So we take our C file and we run it through this compiler and we get this assembly file. And you've seen assembly files in 2150. We assemble that into what's called an object file. And the object file, we do the process of taking our assembly and converting it to machine code, returning it to something that's not quite so human readable. It doesn't have words like add, but has a form that's chosen for the hardware to use that's hopefully convenient for the hardware. So the actual machine code. But then we have this other step called linking, where we take that object file, and only then do we have an executable. So the process of assembling doesn't actually give us something we can run yet. So let's talk about what's missing. You have a concrete example. Here's my program. What's missing from this program? Yeah.
Return zero.
Return zero, okay, so. So it turns out that that's not strictly speaking not necessary. There's a special case in C that it's implied only for main. But yes, something this would be good style. Yeah. Yeah. So printf function. So you might say, well, a lot of people probably didn't say that because they said, well, you included standard io.h, so it works, and you're right. It does, but if we look in standard io.h, what's in standard io.h is going to be something like this. Care star, dot, 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 semicolon. It's just a declaration. There's not actually the code in standard io.h that implements printf. It just says, there is a printf function. And yes, we need that. And yes, we included that. But it doesn't actually have the code. And that means when we look in here, in this assembly file, this has no code for printf is in here because, well, the compiler didn't read it. It wasn't in main.c, and it wasn't in standard io.h or anything it included. So when we look at that.s file, there's no code for printf. And the process of assembling is not going to introduce it. So we're going to still have no code for printf in our object file. And that's what's missing. That's why the object file isn't ready to run. There's no printf in there, even though we're calling it. And we know that ends up working. You know, you don't have to put the code for printf in your hello world.c file. So somehow that works. And what the linking process is doing is it's taking the object file or equivalent, which actually has the code for printf, and it's including it together with main in your executable. Now, you might say, I never specified this printf.o file. Where did that come from? And the compiler just says, unless you specify otherwise, you want the standard C functions linked into your program. So it's done for you unless you explicitly tell the compiler, no, I don't want them. I have my own printf that's much better, thank you. And so you've seen these commands, I think. We have minus s to produce our assembly file, minus c to produce, take our assembly file and produce an object file. And if you don't specify anything, we default to going all the way to an executable. And commonly, you'll do steps where you do multiple of these at once. So for example, the minus C option, which we use to assemble, if you give it a C file instead of an assembly file, it goes, does the compile to assembly to object file, but it doesn't give you a copy of the assembly file. It just puts it in a temporary directory and gets rid of it when it's done. Or something like that. I mean, you can do all the steps together, in which case we still have object files, but you just don't see them. They're just put in a temporary directory, and we get rid of them when we're done. So any questions so far? Our linking is doing. So we know what's roughly here. So let's talk about in more detail what's in these files. So here I have a simple hello.c. In this case, I remember my return zero and use puts to helpfully avoid a new line. So our first step is we take this hello.c and produce an assembly file. So here's an assembly file you might get. I've stripped out a bunch of things that aren't needed. And I have this in AT&T syntax because that's what we're using in this class. We'll talk about how to read AT&T syntax later. The biggest thing, if you're used to Intel syntax, is just that the order of things is reversed. So instead of having subtract 8, we have so instead of having subtract RSP gets 8, we do subtract 8 from RSP. This the order arguments is always destination last. And for the most part, you can guess at this point. There's some other little differences, like registers always start with a percent sign. No exceptions. Okay, so that's the assembly it generates. So we set the argument register to contain the string, which we have a copy of in the assembly file, a pointer to that string, call puts, and return zero. There's some weird things going on here. You might say, why did the compiler add and subtract from RSP? It turns out on Linux, there's a rule that the stack address needs to be a multiple of 16. This is something about the calling convention that I think we don't mention in 2150, but it's part of the Linux calling convention that you're technically violating the calling convention if you call a function without the stack address being a multiple of 16. And so this is code to make that happen. That's why you'll see that when you look at assembly, which you'll have to do for the first assignment, part of why I'm going over this. And we also have XOR to set EAX to zero. You might say, why didn't we just do a move like we did for setting RDI up here? And the reason the compiler does that is mostly because it's shorter machine code. It also happens to be nicer in some other ways, but mostly because it's just shorter machine code. So the compiler generates XOR instead of move. Move would work. It's not like anything where you have to use XOR. Okay, so then we have our assembly file, and we need to convert that to an object file. So our conversion for the assembly file to the object file is that we're going to take, either from our assembly file, just go instruction by instruction and write out the machine code. So our first step is we write out the machine code for sub, for move, call, and so on. So we get that, and this is what that looks like. I don't expect you to know how to decode instructions in there. This is real x86 machine code, which we aren't going to talk about, but I ran this, and this is what the machine code looks like. So this is the text segment. So this is the stuff marked text. That's our code. This file also has a data segment, so we're going to need to put the string there. And I've just written things out in hexadecimal to be consistent. In the actual file, it's bytes. It's the same bytes we use for ASCII, so if you like, you cat the file, you'll see hello world. But I'm writing everything out in hexadecimal to make things consistent between my text segment and my data segment. Okay, and this corresponds to the pieces we see here. But there are some things which we are missing. So one thing you might notice is it turns out that this blue spot here in the machine code is where the value to move into RDI is stored in the machine code. And you might say, that address probably isn't zero. Zero is a null pointer. Why does the machine code have a zero there? And the answer is, well, we're not done yet. We don't know where it's going to be in memory. So what we do in the object file is we just leave it blank, leave it as zero, so we have a placeholder, and we write a note known as a relocation to say, later on, when we actually make the executable, you need to fix that. I left this hole where there should be the address of hello world, but I didn't know the address of hello world yet. Fix that for me before you make the executable. And that's part of the object file, and that's one of the reasons why the object file is different than the executable. And we'll look at that more next time.